Thanks, Alessia. Thank you very much for the invitation to give a talk here. It's really great fun to be here online since we still cannot meet in person. But that is really great to give a talk here late in the evening. Oh, not that late, but so thanks a lot for having me. Today, I would like to give a talk on recent work that my collaborator, who is sitting on the other side of the room, and I published on Archive last month. And it's about, it's already in the title, it's about the sitter space-time scattering amplitudes in the Born approximation. So if I can go to the next slide, yes. So the question that I would like to answer in this talk is essentially, what is the Newtonian potential in the sitter space-time? Now, everybody has done in their quantum field theory course, probably the computation in which you compute the classical potential from a three-level scattering amplitude. This is known as the Born approximation. And you can see this as sort of classical field theory, where you sort of first quantize your quantum fields or your fields. And if you do this in a flat space-time, you can take the non-relativistic limit where all the momenta in the three-level scattering process are much smaller than the typical masses that that enter in the process. And if you do the computation, then I think known to everybody that if you have a massive particle that mediates your scattering process, you obtain a Yukawa potential. And if you set the mass of the mediating particle to zero, you actually recover the Coulomb potential. Now, the question that I would like to answer in this talk is, can you do the same thing, but that now not in a flat Minkowski background, but in the sitter background? So there are already a couple of expectations that we have for this computation. And that is that, the sitter spacetime is a model for an exponentially expanding universe. And I would like to sort of make the conjecture already slightly before I really start talking about the computation, that this should sort of show up in the potential as a repulsive force and sort of forces two particles apart. Now, in general relativity, you can also compute the classical potential in a different way. Namely, you can take the see the sitter metric as a perturbation onto your background metric. So if you sort of model the metric, the attractive force of the of one particle as the Schwarzschild metric, then the cosmological constant will induce an extra correction. And if you then solve the geodesic equation, then you see that a test particle that you throw into this space-time will feel a potential which has a Newtonian term. If I think the mouse is visible for everybody, right? Please tell me if it's not. And the first term is the Newtonian term, so it's an attractive force, but there is also an R squared term which will force particles apart. However, there are a couple of very subtle things happening in the sitter space-time. That is, that if you compute the graviton propagator, then the cosmological constant, if you compute the graviton propagator for an Einstein-Hilbert action in the presence of a cosmological constant, then the graviton propagator will essentially look like the D'Alembertian plus two times the cosmological constant. So it looks like a massive propagator, but this seems to be at odds with the sort of well-known thing that gravitons should be massless. So the question, one question that I would like to address in this talk is the graviton really massless, or is this only true if you neglect the cosmological constant? Secondly, a question that I would like to address that you might ask is, do you see effects from the graviton being a spin two particle in the Newtonian potential? And the sitter spacetime has a very well-known property, and that is that it has a horizon at the sitter radius, the Hubble radius. And it would be very nice if we can see some effects of that horizon. So I should say that the horizon shows up in the sense that if you have two events that are separated by the horizon, then they cannot possibly interact. And well, one thing that I would like to see in the potential is something that reflects this thing. So let's dive in and let's start easy and first do a quick warm-up exercise and see how the Yukawa potential is computed in flat space-time. So we can do this very quickly because I think everybody has seen this. Let's take the easiest theory that you can write down, which is a phi cube theory. You can compute the 2-to-2 scattering amplitude. So it's essentially just this diagram, time from left to right. So you exchange one scalar particle with propagator 1/q² plus m squared. And you have two coupling constants. So the scattering amplitude is just λ² / 2², or I should say the Fourier transform of that. So in order to recover the classical potential, we take the Fourier transform of this object. So we do that here. If you work out all the spherical integrals, you get a couple of signs that show up as some factors of pi. And eventually you are left with a single integral where you integrate over the length of the momentum vector. And if you do this contour integral, then you recover the Yukawa potential. So it's a 1/r potential with an exponential prefactor. And as the radius becomes larger and larger, this exponential is suppressed and we get back to 1/r potential. Mass shows up here in the exponent. If you set the mass to 0, so the mass of the exchange particle, then you recover the exact 1/r potential. So this is the flat space time story, which is rather straightforward. But the first question that we have to address is how do we even compute curved space-time amplitudes? This is a very difficult subject in itself. So we are going to take a very cavalier approach and just start with an action and try to compute propagators just using inverses of two-point functions and three-point functions. But I will get to that in detail on this slide. So for concreteness, let me first introduce the action that we are going to use. So the action will consist of a couple of parts. So for the gravitational action, we will use the Einstein-Hilbert action accompanied by a cosmological constant, which is specifically non-zero. The scalar fields we will take to be minimally coupled and massive. So that's very straightforward too. And we take two different scalar species, so a scalar field phi and a scalar field chi, which has the same form of action. The gravitational action can be gauge fixed. We will use the Donder type covariant gauge fixing, which is all pretty standard. So how do we compute a scattering amplitude from that? For that, we will need vertices and propagators. Now, and it's actually rather straightforward to define these vertices and propagators. So vertices are just given by taking the third functional derivative with respect to the fields. So for our scalar scattering process, we will take one derivative with respect to the metric to obtain a graviton leg. And we take two derivatives with respect to the scalar fields to obtain two scalar legs. Now, that's all fairly standard. The propagator is given by the inverse of the two-point function. So you take two derivatives, functional derivatives with respect to the metric, you invert it, and then you can project onto your desired background. So this will give you a propagation of a graviton from A to B. Now, this is all a very formal way of defining your vertices and propagators. So how do you compute, at least formally, your scattering amplitude from that? You just paste together your vertices and propagators. So you should see the propagator as an operator which sort of takes in one graviton field and spits out a different symmetric tensor field on your spacetime. And similarly, the three-point function is also an operator which takes three arguments. So one graviton field and two scalar fields, and spits out a number. And in that sense, well, you can sort of see this in a dual picture as an operator which takes in two scalar fields and spits out a symmetric two tensor. And in that sense, you can sort of paste together all these operators, which will give you formally a scattering amplitude. Now, in order to make these things a little bit more convenient to work with, it is actually more convenient to work with something that we have coined the amplitude functional. And that is essentially the scattering amplitude, but then contracted explicitly with on-shell scalar fields at the end. So you can sort of see this diagrammatically as the scattering amplitude acting on explicit instances of the scalar field. How does this work in practice? Well, let's take our scalar phi cube theory as an example. Well, we only have the propagator as a non-trivial operator. All the vertices are just scalar numbers. So we let these act on the explicit scalar fields. And what you will get is an integral where the propagator acts on the product of two phi fields, and it's contracted with the product of two chi fields. Now let's do the same for a graviton-mediated process in the Sitter spacetime. So in order to set the stage, let's give a quick lightning review of the Sitter spacetime. Why is it so nice? And why can we actually do computations in it? Well, the Sitter spacetime is actually at the same level of symmetry as your well-known Minkowski spacetime. It's maximally symmetric, constantly curved space. And that is what makes a difference from Minkowski space, that there is actually curvature. Well, it's characterized by a couple of covariant conditions, namely that the Weyl tensor is zero, the Riemann tensor, the Ricci tensor is proportional to the metric, and the constant of proportionality is given by the Ricci scalar, and the Ricci scalar itself is constant. And conventionally, we express the Ricci scalar in terms of the Hubble constant, and in four dimensions, this is the relation. It has a lot of very nice properties. So for instance, it's Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker universe, which means that the metric can be written in this form with a scale factor, which is an exponential. It's also conformally flat, which you can already see from the Weyl tensor being zero. And the scale factor is 1/h² eta squared. The Sitter spacetime is a solution to the Einstein equation with a cosmological for constants. The Einstein equation is R equals 4 lambda, which tells you that h squared is 1/3 of the cosmological constant. And therefore, it is an on-shell background, which is an extremely important property, as we shall see, in order to get to obtain a gauge invariant scattering amplitude. So with all the toolkit, with the toolkit at hand, let's try to compute scattering amplitude in the Sitter spacetime. So how do we define, how do we obtain the Feynman rules for the Sitter spacetime? Let us first consider computing the propagator, which is actually one of the most non-trivial parts in this calculation. As I said before, the propagator is given as the by the inverse of the two-point function. So there is a defining equation that tells you whether something, whether some operator is the propagator. That is that if you sort of contracted with the two-point function, so the second derivative with respect to the metric of the action, and you contract it, then it should give the tensor identity. So this symmetrized Kronecker deltas is the unit operator on the space of symmetric two tensors. Now, in order to compute this object, we can make a good guess, a good ansatz, what this operator should look like. And if you think about it, in the Sitter spacetime, you only have a couple of objects at your disposal which has this index structure, alpha, beta, rho, sigma. So what can happen? You can have a number of functions of the scalar curvature H. And as a second argument of these functions, you can form Dalembertian. And these Dalembertians, they can act on a number of tensor structures, which you can sort of write down all possible combinations. And that can only be formed by using the metric and covariant derivatives. Because there is nothing else in this space-time, these are the only covariant objects that you have at your disposal. So this list actually terminates, and I've written it down here. So you have, for instance, the unit operator, you have the trace operator, you have a couple of tensor structures, tensor operators, which contain two derivatives, and you have one tensor structure, which has four derivatives. Now, the ansatz that we now make is that the propagator is a linear combination with these form factors combined with these operators. And by using the defining equation, we can try to solve this sort of algebraic relation. What do the vertices look like? And now we don't have to do this pesky inversion. We just have to take derivatives with respect to scalar fields and the metric. So the vertices will essentially look like a symmetric two tensor. So you can, for instance, have a metric, rho sigma, acting on something with scalar fields. You can have two uncontracted derivatives. There are a number of other tensor structures that I haven't bothered to write down here. Now, if you now contract two vertices with one propagator, you obtain the scattering amplitude functional. And schematically, it will look like this. So you have derivatives acting on the scalar fields. You have this form factor function of the Dalembertian, and it's contracted again on the other side with a number of scalar fields. Now, in order to now impose all the on-shell relations of the scalar fields, bring this into a nice form, we see already that there is a problem, namely that there are these derivatives which could be contracted, for instance, with the derivative on the other side. So how on earth are we going to commute the covariant derivatives with functions of the Dalembertian? Now, luckily, last year already, in 2020, I did a project together with Benjamin Knoch, who is probably also in the audience here, because he is at BI, where we devised actually a strategy to compute these operators. So this was in the context of not of metric gravity, but the idea is very similar. So if you're already familiar with that paper, then this will be very easy. But let me quickly explain this in the context of metric gravity. So what we want to do is we want to commute a covariant derivative with a function of the Dalembertian. So we want to bring this covariant derivative to the left-hand side of f of box. So how on earth are we going to do this? Well, first, we want to do this for any function, but it's much easier to do this for a particular function. So we're going to expand f by a formal inverse Laplace transform. But yeah, it's formal, so you can also take a more well-defined approach if you want to do this on a Lorentzian background. But in any case, by doing the inverse Laplace transform, you express f of box in terms of a heat operator. And then in order to perform the commutation, we use the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. Now, this is the broad idea. But I've given the easiest example on the bottom of this slide, which is this, the case when this tensor structure X is just a scalar. So there are no tensor indices in this case. So let me guide you through it, because it's really just a linear equation. So we start with our function f of box, which acts on a covariant derivative, which acts in turn on the tensor phi. So the first step is step one in the strategy. We express f of box in terms of an inverse Laplace transform. So inverse Laplace transform is given by such an integral. And then all the operator structure is contained in the heat operator, e to the power minus s of box. So now if we know how to compute the covariant derivative with this operator, we're in business. Luckily, we have the Baker Campbell Hausdorff at our disposal. I've given it here in this form. So essentially, the exponent is given by this infinite sum, where you have a factorial in the denominator. And now all the commutation relations are contained in these repeated commutators. So the subscript I is essentially means that you take the commutator of the commutator of the commutator, etc., I times with d mu. Now, in the sitter spacetime, as I said, all the curvature tensors are extremely simple. So there is no Weyl curvature. The Ricci curvature is related to the Ricci scalar, and the Ricci scalar itself is a constant. So we can actually compute all these repeated commutators, and they are really just a constant to some power of I. So when we have all these repeated commutators, this will essentially just collapse to something to the power I, and we can resum the series. And what we see is that the commutator d mu with f of box will give rise to a shift in the function, and the shift is proportional to the curvature. This can be repeated for tensor structures, so where x has one index, or two indices, or three indices, then of course the commutation relations will be a little bit more difficult. But the general property that you will get shifts in your functions, that's actually a recurring feature. Now, with this non-trivial technique at our disposal, we can actually go back to our contraction and try to bring all the derivatives into a one canonical form. So let's do that. Let's use our commutation formula to compute, first of all, the form factors of the propagator, so that we explicitly know what the propagator looks like, and to contract the two three-point functions with the propagator. And finally, we use the on-shell relation, so the external scalar fields are on-shell, which means that if we act with a box on phi, then it will just give mass. And the result is this central formula here, which one of the central results in our paper is actually extremely simple. So it's let me quickly guide you through it. So we can argue that since the propagator, I should say it differently. So since the vertices have only at most two derivatives, we know that we can bring the amplitude in a form where there are at most two uncontracted derivatives acting on each type of scalar field, so each on one side of the propagator. Now, then there are just two tensor structures that are left, so we can have a contraction of this T mu nu tensor, which is two derivatives acting on a scalar field, then symmetrized over the scalar fields. Or we can just have the product of the scalars. Inside, and these are sandwiched, these are sandwiching, the non-trivial propagator structure, which are these inverse functions. So I will use a slightly sloppy terminology and just refer to these box plus Z inverse as propagators. They're of course not really propagators. So what are the nice things that we can already see at this level? So first of all, the sitter space amplitude is explicitly gauge invariant. So I did not mention this, but we didn't really use a standard Donder gauge fixing, but we used one with a generalized gauge parameter. But this gauge parameter explicitly drops out when we put the scalar fields and the background metric on shell. Second thing that we notice is that it's explicitly symmetric in all of the scalar fields. So we can interchange phi and chi, and we can also interchange one and two if we want, which is of course what you would expect because the diagram is very symmetric. But one thing that is really a little bit cumbersome perhaps is the appearance of these sort of massive propagators form B squared, box plus M squared inverse. So we see that there are two types of masses. So we see, well, I will refer to these as masses, but that's of course a little bit subtle. There are two values of these parameters. So we have one which is positive at the value 2h², and one which is negative, which may look a little bit worrisome. So just by looking at this propagator or this scattering amplitude, you might think, well, maybe we have a problem because this one is negative, this mass parameter is negative. So there might be a tachyon in this scattering amplitude. However, I should stress here that these are really sort of abstract inverse non-local operators on a curved background. So we should be very careful with making statements like, oh yeah, the mass parameter is negative, so there must be a tachyon there, which is really a flat space-time concept. That is essentially also summarizes one of the big problems with this amplitude functional, and that is that it is a rather abstract object. So it's extremely simple looking, but in order to really infer numbers out of it, we have to do more work. And that is why we embark on the computation of a classical potential. So that actually brings me to our approximation scheme that we have to do, because we already see in the scattering amplitude functional a very big problem. And that is that we have these functions of boxes acting on products of scalar fields. If you only have one box, that is not really much of a problem to distribute it. But if you have an entire function of boxes, that is actually more difficult. So the question that we have to answer here is, how do we distribute a function of D'Alembertians of the product of two scalar fields? For that, we use an approximation scheme. We make an expansion in something that is the non-relativistic limit, so where the masses are very large. However, in contrast to Minkowski space, which doesn't have a length scale of its own, I noticed that my screen is turning yellow because it's turning into night mode. Is it also turning yellow for you?
No, it is
white. Okay, that is great. Then for me, it's not a problem, but... So in Minkowski space, there is no length scale of its own because it's flat. And that means that the only expansion parameter that we have is the mass over the momentum. However, the sitter spacetime has an intrinsic length scale, namely the Hubble length. So we can try to make an expansion in the massless parameter where the mass over the Hubble length is much larger than one. So in order to do this, let's take a look at an explicit solution to the equation of motion for these scalar fields. So for this, we will use so-called bunched Davies vacuum, where the scalar fields are solved by in the spatial slices just by a plane wave. And because you have an explicit time dependence, your time dependence of your wave functions will also become a little bit more intricate. It will turn into a Hankel function. So this Hn, I will use the convention that for particles that are ingoing, have a Hankel function of the second kind. And if you have an outgoing particle, it's the Hankel function of the first kind. So this is a very standard procedure to choose your vacuum, because it's explicitly the sitter invariant, satisfies Hadamard properties and all kinds of other things. But one thing that we have shown in our paper is that there is another nice property of the bunched Davies vacuum, and that is that it's the unique vacuum which admits a well-defined expansion in 1/d-mass parameter. And we can see this when we distribute a D'Alembertian, we can put this to good use when we try to distribute a D'Alembertian over the product of two scalar fields. So if you work this out, you can sort of split this into coordinates. Then if you get the two D'Alembertians which act on each of the two factors, you will get a factor of m squared. The spatial part of the D'Alembertian will give you two momenta, But the non-trivial bit here is that that you have two time derivatives which distribute over the two phis. And for this, we have to use our expansion. Now, I will not go in too much into the details of how to compute this expansion, but what you will actually find is that to leading order in 1 over the mass, you find that this is actually given by q squared, which is the difference of the two momenta of phi 1 and phi 2, multiplied by a time-dependent prefactor. And the rest is subleading. So you see now that the product of phi 1 and phi 2, in contrast to Minkowski spacetime, is not an eigenfunction of a box anymore. So in Minkowski spacetime, this prefactor h squared eta squared is 1. So it's actually a proper eigenfunction. But in the Sitter spacetime, it is only an approximate eigenfunction. And because this is time dependent again, well, if you act again with the D'Alembertian, then you will also get a contribution from this leading order term. So how do we sort of put this to use to actually compute the distribution of propagators on the product of scalar fields? So in order to resolve the propagator, we'll actually go into a slightly more general scheme than just computing it for the mass parameters that we have seen. So we want to compute the propagators for box minus parameter z, which you can parameterize by a dimensionless parameter zeta. And the story is roughly the same as how you compute the propagator operator. You make an ansatz which sets, which is the most general thing that you can write out, which respects all the symmetries. So the simplest thing that you can try to do is to compute what is the propagator acting on just the product of two scalar fields. Now, the resulting function must again be a scalar function. So there's no tensor structure present that will give you anything difficult. So, and we have seen that when you act with one box on the product of two scalar fields, it will just give you back a time-dependent function times your product of two scalar fields. So the ansatz that we are going to make is that to leading order in the in one of the mass, it is just given by some function which we still have to compute. Now, before we go into the details about how we compute the tensorial bit, let me now give the strategy how to compute this function g0. Well, we use again the defining property of the propagator, and that is that when you act with a two-point function again, you will get the identity. So the strategy is to act on this object again with box minus theta h squared on the combination of the prefactor eta and the two phis. Now, this is an operator which has finitely many boxes. So we know how it distributes over the function and the product of the two scalar fields. And then we use the defining identity that these are each other's inverses in order to derive a coupled, well, this for the tensor bit, but at least you get a second order inhomogeneous differential equation. Second order, because this function g will have two derivatives with respect to conformal time eta. It's inhomogeneous because you will get derivative stuff which is equal to 1 on the right hand side. And that's what the differential equation looks like. Now, as I said, the scalar, scalar propagator does not have any tensor structure. How do we deal with the tensor structure, which is the contraction of two derivatives? Well, for that, we actually look at what this tensor looks like component by component. So this tensor T mu nu sort of splits up into four sectors. We have the 0,0 component of this tensor. We have the I0 component, where I is a spatial index. And then we have the completely special sector of the tensor. Again, we parameterize the, we make an ansatz for this operator by saying that it should look like tensor structures times some function. For the 0,0, it's exactly the same as in the scalar case. We only have one tensor structure, if you wish, at your disposal, which is a scalar thing. But for the spatial cross time sector, you have two tensor structures that you can write down. You can have a P1, you can have a P2, which comes each come with a function that is to be computed. And in the same manner, there are five functions for the purely spatial sector. Again, we do the same strategy as what we did for the scalar case. We act with a box minus theta h squared. We distribute the finite number of boxes. We use the identity to derive a differential equation. And because, two functions in the spatial cross-time sector and five functions in the IJ sector, this will result in a coupled system of differential equations, which are a little bit more tricky to solve than the single equations. So because this system of equation is rather long, I will not print it here on a slide because I don't think that it makes that much sense to print it. However, I will tell you a little bit about how we solved it. We solved it by using the power series ansatz. This is also known as the Frobenius method, which essentially says, assume that your function, that each function gi is of the form eta to some power and then an analytic series. We require that all these functions are analytic. And then we actually were able to solve the system of equations. It was actually not super easy, but and the solution was also rather long. This is again why I didn't print it. But it does have a number of striking features. But first of all, the leading order in the masses, the solution to the amplitude is a function of the co-moving momentum only. And in fact, it's actually a function of eta times the co-moving momentum only, which we recognize as the proper momentum that is being exchanged. This is similar to the Minkowski space scattering amplitude, which is only a function of the transferred momentum as well. And this has a very clear interpretation in terms of what the potential looks like. If you scattering amplitude is a function of the length of the transferred momentum only, then the potential will be spherically symmetric, it will be central. Now, the solution, as I said, is rather complicated. It contains quite many hypergeometric functions. So I will not make a list of it here. But luckily, it doesn't contain any free parameters anymore. So we can just make a plot of it. And this is where it is. This is what it is. So there are a number of very striking features compared to what you would expect from the Minkowski space potential, which is just 1/Q². Let's go through the properties a little bit. But first of all, it doesn't look like the 1/Q² in a lot of ways. First of all, it has a finite limit as the momentum goes to zero. So in Minkowski space, it would just go to infinity. But here there is no infrared divergence. This is a little bit reminiscent of the mass-like behavior of the propagator, what you would expect in Minkowski space from massive propagators, which also have a finite limit if you take the transferred momentum to zero. But of course, the most striking feature in this plot is that it doesn't sort of smoothly go to zero, but very quickly it starts to oscillate. Actually, if you compute the asymptotics of the function, it is really just a cosine. Well, we thought about this for a very long time. We were a bit puzzled why this is the case. because it seems now that there are discrete values of the transferred momentum where a transition, which is essentially what a scattering amplitude is forbidden. So one interpretation that we gave to it is that this is reminiscent of particle in a box-like behavior. Because if you have a particle in a box, then there are discrete values where a transition is allowed. This is actually sort of the inverse case. Now we find transitions which are explicitly forbidden in the Sitter spacetime. So it seems like the curvature of the universe will induce some boundedness behavior, some bounded-like behavior into the universe. So I should say that since this fracture Q is a dimensionless number, it is the transferred momentum in units of the Hubble constant. The period is of the order of the Hubble energy, which is extremely tiny in sort of human measure. But it also means that if you take the limit where the Hubble constant becomes zero, then these oscillations will compress and compress and compress. And when the Hubble constant becomes zero, it will retrieve this sort of continuum, inverted continuum in the sense that it contains forbidden momentum transfers. But you will, you obtain the continuum again. So that is the scattering amplitude. So we're already almost there in the computation of our potential. We only have to compute the Fourier transform of this scattering amplitude. So again, well, we expressed our scattering amplitude in terms of momentum in units of the Hubble constant. We'll also take the Fourier transform in where the radius is in terms of the Hubble constant. So we introduce this fracture R, which is a geodesic length. And the potential is now given by Fourier transforming the potential, the scattering amplitude with respect to this dimension that's R. Now again, we can imagine the story if you have a very complicated scattering amplitude with hypergeometric functions, and what you get out is also a lot of difficult hypergeometric functions, so I'll put them here. But what you get out is actually something very striking, and that is that there is now a splitting in the domain of this function. If the radius is larger than one, note that this is in Hubble units, the potential vanishes identically. It's analytically zero. Below the Hubble radius, there is some potential. And as I said, it's rather complicated. It has a rational part, many fractions, and also a lot of hypergeometric functions. But now the arguments of the hypergeometric functions have interchanged. So now it's not a 1F2, but a 2F1. And what is also very nice is that we can make a plot out of this potential in order to sort of study its properties. So the amplitude, the scattering potential is given here. We've divided out Newton's constant and the masses, made it dimensionless. But it sort of looks like this jump, and you see here this jump where you cross R equals one. So can we derive some analytical details for this potential? Let us first see whether we really did a good job in deriving something which looks like the Newtonian potential. To this end, we made an expansion around R equals zero. So you see that there is a divergence here. And lo and behold, the leading order term in this expansion is exactly the minus one of R term. Secondly, we have a constant term, which was turned out to be five. And there is also a linear term. And already at this level, you can sort of just make it out here in the plot, the dotted line here. This is actually the curve that is given here. So already at this level, it is a very good approximation. As I said, the one over R term, that is exactly the reproducing the classical regime. So it means that if you have are at very, very small distances in Hubble units, then you really only see the classical Newtonian behavior. So Newtonian gravity, that is safe. However, there are also corrections. We have a linear term, which comes with a minus sign in the potential. So if we compute the force, which is minus the derivative with respect to R, then we see that this will give rise to a force term, which is g Newton times the mass, times one mass, times the other mass, times four in terms of Hubble units. And because we've, the force is minus ddr, this will actually turn into a plus sign. So the force has the opposite sign of the one over r term. And therefore we interpret this as a repulsive force indeed, which is consistent with the interpretation of the curvature of the universe giving an expansion. Now, we note here that this is not the potential that you would expect from the geodesic equation. So recall that this is a one over r term, and then you would get an r squared term rather than a linear term. So we were a bit puzzled by this and actually also a little bit disappointed. But then we thought about it a little bit deeper into what is actually what are actually the assumptions that go into the derivation of the geodesic potential. And that is that you have a heavy particle which sort of deforms your space-time and gives your attractive Schwarzschild potential. But the potential is felt by a test particle that you bring into the universe. Of course, a test particle must not deform space-time itself, and therefore it must be light. And this is in contradiction with the approximation that we made, which is that both masses are very large. So speculating a little bit here, we would actually have two very heavy particles that we bring into the universe. So tentatively speaking, this would sort of probe a geometry where actually two black holes would start to feel each other. And in addition, we also have a cosmological constant, which is forcing these two things apart. But yeah, this is rather speculative, since as far as I know, there are no exact solutions known where there are two black holes in the presence of each other. That is kind of hard to really check. Now, so this is about the expansion around r equals zero. Let us now take a look at the other end of the universe. Let's take a look at this weird jump at r equals one. Now recall that r is the dimensionless distance in Hubble units. So that means that r equals one corresponds exactly to the Hubble radius or to the sitter radius. So exactly at r equals one, the potential jumps from something finite to zero. This is exactly at the de Sitter horizon. So we interpret this as the fact that there is no causal interaction beyond the de Sitter horizon. So you can imagine that if two particles are separated for more than the Hubble distance, then they cannot have causal interaction with each other, especially no gravitational force can be interchanged with each other. So therefore the potential must be zero or at least constant. This jump is also has a very nice effect because it means that the support of the potential is bounded from above. That means that if you want to sort of integrate over all possible ingoing states, then at some point you should sort of reach the level where you have all states. Then you should reach one because of unitarity. So usually if you have a one over r potential, then this integral will diverge because it goes to zero too slow. However, if you have this jump, then you can actually always cut off your r integral. And there is no infrared divergence. And this is sort of the dual observation from the fact that the scattering amplitude is finite at q equals zero. But if you do a Fourier transform of this potential again, then exactly at if you want to evaluate at q equals zero, you have to integrate over all radii. And if that integral is finite, then also the scattering amplitude at q equals zero should be finite. Now, what was kind of puzzling for us is that before the Hubble horizon, the potential is not zero. So we are a bit puzzled by that. And I can actually show you how big this jump is by because I've plotted here the residue of the potential minus the approximated function, which I showed on the previous slide. And you see that indeed it's not zero. It jumps from some very small negative value to zero. So we were a bit puzzled about how to interpret this discontinuity. We are not quite sure what to make of it. So one idea that we were playing around with a little bit is that you can maybe make an analogy with electrodynamics. If you have a jump in the electric potential, then this is usually associated with a surface charge density. And of course, the gravitational analog of that is the surface energy density. It would also be very interesting to speculate what would happen if you have a quantum mechanical particle that lives either inside or outside the Hubble radius and starts to quantum mechanically tunnel in or out of the universe. And that is sort of reminiscent of maybe giving a sort making a link to a thermodynamic description of what is going on at the center horizon. But as I said, this is very speculative. We don't know what is going on here. And I would actually be very interested to hear your thoughts about this. Now, let me quickly summarize what I've talked about. We've computed the scattering amplitude functional in a de Sitter background, with that we used a novel way of computing commutator relations. From that, we computed a scattering amplitude and a potential in the large mass limit by computing propagator, actin, and protostar fields. The scattering amplitude had some very interesting properties, which are caused by the presence of background curvature. For instance, there is no IR divergence. We have these oscillations. We saw that there seems to be a repulsive force at large distances, and we actually reproduced the causal properties of the de Sitter spacetime that it is vanishing outside the de Sitter horizon. Now, with that, I think my time is almost up, so I'm sorry that I went almost over time, but I would like to thank you for your attention, and possibly if there is time, welcome any questions.
Thanks, Chris, for the very interesting talk. Okay, are there questions?
So the question is, can you comment on what might cause the oscillations of the scattering amplitude? So I think it is related to, let me get the PowerPoint back. So I think it is related to what I said about these forbidden momentum transfers. So is the screen sharing back, by the way?
Yes, it's not full screen, but
Well, it's maybe easier to go through the slides a little bit. I mean, of course, it's not completely clear. It's just what comes out of the computation, but you can sort of make sense of it by the observation that all the interactions must take place within the Hubble volume. So the interaction is sort of confined in a bounded space. And that is why we think that it's caused by sort of these finite size effects, that it's a sort of partial discretization of the spectrum. And then, well, if you want to have sort of discrete points in your scattering amplitude in some way, but don't want to really make it discontinuous, then an oscillation is what should come out. Yeah. Thanks.
Are there other questions? Okay, Benjamin.
Hey Chris, thanks for this really nice talk. Maybe one physical question, one more technical question. The physical question about this jump of the potential, it just came to my mind. Is it maybe related to a kind of shock wave that's moving outward because you have the sitter space or the Hubble radius is expanding outwards, and then it's kind of driving a shock wave because suddenly you can interact with matter inside of the Hubble radius?
That is a very interesting suggestion, I think. We haven't thought about it, so yeah, that it's very well possible. Yeah. So it's yeah. But the answer is I don't know.
Okay, good. The more technical question is, so for solving these differential equations, you have used a specific coordinate system, right? Have you investigated other coordinate systems? And if so, do the differential equations look more easy or more difficult? Is there maybe a different coordinate system where the differential equations are solvable analytically?
No, we have not tried any other coordinate system because this is by far the easiest coordinate system to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that it's conformally flat, which means that you have sort of flat spatial slices, which means that you only have to, that here you can just go to momentum space and you only have the time dependence to take care of. And any other coordinate system will cause more problems. At the moment, I am currently working to investigate scattering on a black hole background, on a Schwarzschild background. That is, of course, not conformally flat, but it does have spherical symmetry. And at the moment, much of the computation that we have done so far, we're following a paper that came out 2 years ago, but this seems to be feasible for general spherically symmetric backgrounds. So it would be very interesting to see whether we can sort of split off that computation and then not insert a Schwarzschild metric, but a static the sitter metric.
Yeah, definitely.
My intuition says that the differential equations will not be easier.
But that's the point about differential equations. The equation might look more complicated, but then it might be of a very special form where we know the analytic solution. And yes, it's really difficult to predict that because you can change one number by a factor of two in a second order differential equation, suddenly you have no idea what's going on anymore.
Yes, yeah, that is true. So I think the only way is to compute it and see what happens.
Yeah, but you haven't tried it.
No. Okay. Another thing would be very interesting is to try to compute this in the global coordinate system. So there is a coordinate system where you sort of cover the sitter hyperboloid in one coordinate patch. That would also be very interesting to study that.
Yeah.
But there also you don't have flat spatial slices.
Maybe it's also a good check to I think to check what of these statements are potentially coordinate dependent and which statements are not coordinate dependent. So I guess you get a similar picture that at some point the potential or the force should be zero because that makes sense physically. But maybe this is in other coordinate systems, there is no jump or I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. That would definitely be very interesting. Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, let me also, no, okay, I give the word to Nosrat, and then I will ask some questions.
Oh, sorry. Excuse me? Do you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I can hear you, but I now also see you.
Hello there? Yeah. Hello. Excuse me. Thank you for a nice talk. Also, we are doing a similar work with scattering amplitude in graviton and its relation to the modified provocator, which is originated from ESR, double social relativity. We have the same situation, but for massless graviton, if we add something like fourth order of the momentum with respect to the fourth of the momentum slash second order of the Planck mass, if we add this term to the propagator, we have the equal potential in the potential that you used in the beginning of your talk. You have equal potential scattering. Also, we have the same situation for massless graviton. But for modified massless gravity, is there any possibility to relate your results to modified dispersion relation in double social relativity?
Well, first of all, can you please remind me what doubly special relativity is?
Doubly special relativity, DSR.
Yeah, so what is the fundamental concept of DSR?
Is it possible to relate your results also to double associativity?
I think that Chris is asking what is exactly doubly special relativity.
Yeah, doubly associative relation in here. Is it possible to have, if you start from a modified propagator, like something like this?
But that is probably related. I don't know. Because doubly, I think that you are talking about something involving the Lorentz violations, right?
Exactly, because we have a little bit similar results with massless graviton and modified propagator. Not exactly the same, but we have, for example, the cover potential in there and scattering amplitudes is similar to that.
But it's hard to make any statements about specific models. So for instance, if you want to add masses to your graviton, in that direction, we have done some extra work where we add quadratic curvature invariance to the action. So, for instance, an R square term and a square of the Weyl tensor. This will do to the graviton propagator is that it will add a mode, a massive mode in the scalar sector of the graviton, and it will add a massive mode in the spin two sector of the graviton. We did compute the scattering amplitude functional already. So it is not published work yet, but it's in the pipeline. And we are currently studying the properties of the scattering potential. And it seems to have at short distances, it seems to have a similar effect as what it does in flat space time. So what is very special about quadratic gravity is that the potential gets finite. We reproduce that. But the long distance behavior, we haven't quite under control yet. So these functions are quite difficult to evaluate. So we're still doing that.
Maybe some features of scattering is not model dependent, but some of them are model dependent. And maybe I can email you some details of exact model that we are studying, and we can discuss with emails. It's better. Maybe here I cannot describe exactly our model, and we have a different model. But in future communication, we can talk about that through email.
Yeah. Probably it's difficult to compare if Chris does not look at the specific paper.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nosso. Okay, other questions? Okay, let me finally ask my questions. So I wanted to ask, related to the specific form of the potential that you found. So at some point you have shown an analytical approximation for the potential where you have a constant term and a term that is linear in R. First question is whether that form depends on lambda that you choose. So in a sense, depends on h squared, probably that 5 really comes out for a specific value of lambda, right?
Yeah, so that this is sort of modeled out in this exact representation is because I've expressed everything in terms of dimensionless variables. So the radius here is actually the dimension full radius times the Hubble constant. So the Hubble constant has units of inverse length.
Mm-hmm.
So R times the Hubble radius times the Hubble constant is dimensionless. So if you restore all the units, then you see that the leading term is exactly the minus g m1 m2 over r term. The constant is slightly unphysical anyway, because if you take the derivative to actually compute the force, it will go away. And you see that the linear term is proportional to h. So in the flat limits, so where h goes to zero, this completely goes away and there is no correction to the one over r potential. But indeed the potential does depend on the Hubble constant, yes.
Okay, great. And this also answer my second question, that was like whether the limit lambda that goes to zero was continuous. So if yes, you take that smaller and smaller, you would get the standard potential. And also, I guess, the dimension full units that the Hubble the horizon would go to infinity, and then one yes, recovers exactly the standard causality yeah, relation.
Exactly.
Okay. And then second question or third question is whether you have in mind any method to do the same calculation, but for any mass of the scalar, of the two scalars, because in that case, you could then also test what happens in the limit where m goes to zero, and the recover, in a sense, the result of the standard associated potential that is, I mean, with the test particle.
Yeah, that is a good question, which is slightly difficult to answer because we introduced this expansion for a technical reason.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed it to compute the distribution of the propagator over the product of two fields. However, it is an expansion. So in principle, we can compute the next two leading order. That it would actually be quite interesting because the leading order seems to give a central potential, but the subleading terms might actually be angle dependent. So you might see a scattering process, which depends on how exactly how in which direction the particles are coming. One could speculate that it's possible to compute this up to the order where you also compute the order one term. So not order m squared, not order m, but order m to the power zero. And then sort of cavalierly throw away all the divergent terms and say, well, this is also the result, what comes out in for the massless particles. But it is kind of a tricky limit because we expand in 1 over m, which is ill-defined for m equals 0. But yeah, that would definitely be interesting, but we're still 2 expansion orders away from that.
Yeah, I mean, I would have guessed that was at least a big field.
Yes.
Okay. Time for maybe one last question or comment, if there is any. Benjamin.
Someone else wants to ask one. I just realized, so strictly speaking, you're not completely on shell with the sitter space-time, because obviously you have an energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side of the Einstein's equation. So there is a relation between the tensor and the Einstein tensor, right? And in general, you would probably not get a de Sitter space. So I was wondering, could one maybe find a scalar field configuration on the Sitter space, where the Sitter space is actually on shell, including the scalar field, where also the scalar field is on shell, and then do the computation again? Because then you're completely on shell with all the configuration, and you might get something even closer to physics.
Well, two things. The first thing is we are completely on shell because the equations of motion of the scalar fields is just the Klein-Gordon equation. So the zero field configuration is on shell. So our VEV is zero.
Yeah.
So that means that the stress energy tensor is zero, and therefore the sitter is an on-shell solution. However, it is a very interesting question to see what happens when you choose a non-zero VEV.
Yeah.
We have a couple of ideas, and one of them is indeed add a self-interaction to the scalar, say four-point interaction or something, which shifts the VEV. You can even take a constant VEV just to make things easier. And then see how what changes in the amplitude. So I would expect something like a shift in the cosmological constant, but it would be interesting to figure out whether there are any other effects.
Okay, thank you.
I think I don't see other questions, and we are also running out of time. So I would ask all of you to unmute yourself to thank Chris again for the very nice talk and discussion.